Congratulations! You made it to the weekend. And oh man, last week I opened this show saying there'd been kind of a hurricane of news. This week apparently took that as a challenge. I'm Lizzie O'Leary, and this is Marketplace Weekend, where the economy meets real life. Obviously, lots of developments in Washington. The president is on his first overseas trip after telling reporters he did not ask then-FBI Director James Comey to back off an investigation into his national security advisor, Michael Flynn.
And also, as you look back...
No. Next question.
But there's lots of other stuff out there that you may have missed, and we'll get into it all this hour. Remember, you can always come talk to me or the team. Email us. We're weekend@marketplace.org or on Twitter. We're @MarketplaceWKND. This crazy news week does affect a lot of different things. And so to prepare you for the week to come, we're going to start with our segment Long and Short. That's when we borrow terms from the world of finance to talk about the news. Long as in betting on something, short as in betting against it. And this week we have The Atlantic's Jillian White and The LA Times' Natalie Kitcheroff. Welcome back to both of you.
Hi, Lizzie.
Thanks for having us.
So, all right, I want to mix this up a little bit. I'm going to start with a short, the thing we are betting against, or one of you is betting against. Jillian, why don't you throw out your short first and explain it to us?
Yeah, sure. So I am short full employment. I'm not sure that we will ever get to full employment, but I am short both on the idea that we have a great definition of full employment and that we have reached it. So as of the last jobs report, a lot of people were saying that we were either at full employment or near full employment. And that's in part because the jobless rate, the unemployed rate, has been so low for so long.
Yeah, 4.4%. That's low.
Yeah, it's great. It's wonderful. Except for the fact that a lot of economists that I've talked to agree that the unemployment rate should not be the sole factor in determining whether or not we are technically at full employment. Full employment, in theory, is this kind of robust figure of everyone who wants to have a job, you know, can work and is making a good living. And the thing that people are concerned about are a couple of things. So one, it's that labor force participation, while it's not still falling, hasn't really risen all that much. So there are a bunch of people who would normally be working who are not in the labor force, and that gives a lot of people pause. And two, wage growth is not as fast as people want it to be. There's been a little growth, but the acceleration has been pretty paltry. So the idea that the job market is completely healed and that there's no more growth that could happen there in terms of wages, in terms of participation, I don't think we're there yet, and a lot of people seem to kind of be on the same page. So calling it full employment right now really only looks at that unemployment rate, and that just doesn't seem to be robust enough.
Well, this is a thing I have questions about, because you and I and Natalie, we think about this concept, economists think about this concept, but if you ask just about any regular person on the street, they'd probably laugh in our faces if we told them that the economy was at full employment right now.
Yeah. There's such a disconnect right now between what the data might say in terms of the unemployment rate and what people are actually feeling. So I think there's this gap that everyone wants to kind of fill where the data might show something different and it would reflect more closely what people are actually feeling in their everyday lives.
So I want to turn this slightly because, Natalie, your short fits really well into this conversation. Tell me what you're short.
Yes. I am short women's participation in the workforce. So a lot of the focus has been on missing men. Why are men not looking for work anymore? And this has been a really long-term decline for men in their participation rate. Women are a different story because for a half a century, women were increasing their participation in the labor force steadily. And then around 2000, really in 99, that peaked and has since declined. We're now at 74% for prime age women. Why are women staying at home? What has changed sort of from the 90s to today? You know, there's a lot of very kind of women-specific reasons why women may be staying home. One of them is the fact that the cost of childcare has risen while wages have not grown as quickly as they were when women were kind of entering the workforce in droves.
Yeah, it's hard to make that math work. I mean, childcare costs a lot of money.
Right. There are other problems with our workforce that are keeping women out of it. Janet Yellen, the chairwoman of the Fed, recently gave a speech at Brown where she essentially said, if we can't fix this problem, we're going to have a problem because our population is aging. You know, the president wants to limit immigration. In order to become more productive as an economy, we need to have people doing work, producing more things. And women are half the population.
And that conversation about women in the workforce is one that Natalie Kitchoff, who's an economy reporter for the LA Times, will publish soon. We're also talking with Gillian White, a senior associate editor at The Atlantic. Gillian, I want to turn it back to you and go with what you are long. What are you betting on?
So I am long the impact of the CBO score, which will be released next week. CBO meaning Congressional Budget Office, which is the nonpartisan office that is responsible for taking a look at legislation and figuring out basically what the cost-benefit analysis of it is.
And we're talking about the health care bill passed by the GOP House here, yes?
Yes, exactly. So the House went ahead and pushed forward with their health care bill ahead of the CBO scoring, which a lot of people were critical of. Because, as I said, the CBO score kind of comes out and says, all right, this is how much money will be saved. This is how much it will cost. And in the past, the CBO has come out with some figures that have been kind of devastating for the GOP's plans for repeal and replace. So last time they went ahead and did their score, it was the famed CBO number of 24 million, and that was 24 million more people who would be uninsured by 2026 based on the Republican repeal and replace bill. And that was kind of the thing that people really blamed or credited, depending on what side you're on, with kind of derailing the whole plan. And I just think that the CBO score still has a lot of weight to it. I think it will hold some impact, and a lot of people are waiting to see what it looks like. And honestly, a lot of people that I've talked to here in Washington don't think that much will have changed from the last report.
I don't know. I might have to disagree with you. Not being long the CBO, but I'm sort of short anything that is trying to move on Capitol Hill amid this incredibly frenetic news environment. You know, we have seen stocks drop this week. I think that is the stock market saying, maybe we're probably not going to get tax reform. There is, in Washington, often a limited amount of political bandwidth. I think healthcare may have an easier time than tax reform, but I don't know, man. There's a lot going on Capitol Hill, and legislating is hard.
That is a thing we all learned recently, right?
Natalie, why don't you tell us what you're long?
So I am long on trade and services. When Donald Trump talks about the deficit, he really harps on manufactured goods, steel, sort of durable products.
Our trade deficit with other countries?
Yeah, that's right. The reality is that where we hold the biggest advantage is in services. And I'm talking about kind of high-level services, financial services, anything involved with the internet, consulting, architecture, you know, financial payment systems. These are the kinds of innovations that the U.S. is out in front of. And right now, only 5% of U.S. businesses that produce exportable services are exporting them.
Huh.
That is a huge opportunity. 25% of manufacturers are exporting. So that divide there gives you a sense of just how much room we have to grow. And we're not focusing on it right now, but if we were to kind of step up our pressure on our trading partners to remove barriers for trade in services, for example, opening up channels for data to flow between countries more easily, that would really lift a lot of our homegrown technological financial services.
Helping us get a jump on the economic news for the week ahead, that was Natalie Kitchoff from the LA Times and Gillian White from The Atlantic. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
Thanks, Lizzie.
Listening to the show, then you know that we're delving into infrastructure and we'll be on the road this summer looking at some of the worst issues in America. And while infrastructure is not the most inspiring of words, and trust me, we have tried to find different ways to say it, we all feel the impact when things don't work. Think broken transportation systems, crumbling schools, compromised water supplies, super slow internet service, or none. President Trump says that infrastructure is a priority for him and has pledged a $1 trillion investment. So tell us, what's broken in your neighborhood? Megan McCarthy emailed us this voice memo from Philadelphia.
I live in West Philly, and I've noticed in the past 3 years that within about a 2-block radius of where I live, there have been sinkholes. And I'm not talking just like, oh, hey, that's a big pothole. I'm talking like, oh, hey, somebody's car got swallowed. I wonder if their insurance covers that. There was one on Larchwood, which is kind of a smaller street, so whatever. And there was one on Spruce, which was, you know, a pretty big street. And then there was one on Baltimore Ave, which is like a main thoroughfare. I don't know. That just seems kind of ridiculous to me.
Keep your comments coming. You can email us at weekend@marketplace.org or leave us a voicemail. Just call 1-800-648-5114. There was a news story that caught our eye this week that said it costs about the same amount to keep an inmate in prison in California for a year as it would to send them to Stanford. One reason that's come up lately is that Attorney General Jeff Sessions reversed an Obama-era criminal justice policy that sought leniency for low-level drug offenses and other nonviolent crimes. Sessions has now told prosecutors to go after the toughest possible penalties and sentences. But this is Marketplace, so we come back to the numbers. Prison is expensive. And since we're talking about taxpayer dollars, we wanted to ask what kind of return on investment we are all getting. Professor Charis Kubrin studies the cost of incarceration at the University of California, Irvine. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
You know, people like to throw out numbers, say, oh, it costs X amount in this state or that. Well, what is the sort of average number of how much it costs to incarcerate someone?
Well, that varies state by state. In my state of California, for example, it costs upwards of $60,000 per inmate per year to house them in prison. That's quite a bit. And so if you're talking about adding additional time through mandatory minimum sentences, and you're doing that across offenders and adding many years on, you can see how very quickly that cost can escalate. It's very costly to maintain prisons. There are high security facilities. There's a lot of technology involved. You have to pay workers there. There's health care that's involved with inmates. There's all sorts of costs associated with keeping someone locked up in a maximum security facility.
Is there some sort of magic number where incarceration pays off?
So, of course, we have to use incarceration. It's an important tool in our crime-fighting toolbox, if you will. I think everyone would agree that incarceration and even mandatory minimum penalties can be useful or effective if they're utilized against the right category of offenders. So I think there's little pushback to using mandatory minimums and other severe penalties when you have very high-level offenders, offenders that are violent, that pose a significant threat to society, and for whom locking them up for a long period of time would actually not only help public safety, but reduce costs associated with crime. The concern, though, is that there's a net widening going on with these sorts of policies whereby it's not just those high-level offenders that get caught up with the mandatory minimums. It's a lot of low-level offenders. And that's when you start seeing diminishing returns, both in terms of crimes prevented as well as the cost effectiveness.
You know, you study the sort of cost of incarceration, and there was one thing that I'm really curious about that I wanted to get your take on. There was a study that came out last year from Washington University in St. Louis, and they found all sorts of things about how much incarceration costs. But there was one thing that kind of blew my mind, which was that high levels of incarceration might actually increase crime and not deter it. How does that work?
Yes. So, I mean, that's an interesting point because we tend to assume that more incarceration will result in less crime because people are deterred. Both the individuals that are in prison, well, they're in prison, they can't commit another crime. And you hear people saying that all the time. Well, we know at least this individual can't commit any more crime. But we also make the assumption that those of us outside of prison will learn from the lessons of those that have been caught and be deterred to commit crime. Deterrence works to a certain point. However, there is also a competing force that you have to understand or take into account, which is that individuals in prison may also actually exacerbate their criminal propensities by learning how to engage in crime, by consulting with other individuals in prison who they learn from, by hardening their approach to crime, that sort of thing. So the assumption that prisons are going to necessarily reform and that when folks get out, they're in better shape is faulty. And in fact, as you mentioned, there is some evidence to suggest that prisons may do more harm for certain kinds of offenders. And I think in many cases, that's the low-level offenders I was mentioning before.
Well, so what then, easy question here, should a society do? I mean, even nonviolent crimes do have victims. So how do we look at this from even a rudimentary cost-benefit analysis standpoint?
Right. I mean, that's the key question, is you want to make sure you are putting away the most serious violent offenders, keeping them off the streets, and doing sort of the most effective use of the resources with the least harm for offenders, victims, and their families. And that's a very difficult calculation to figure out. I'm not quite sure exactly what that calculation looks like on the ground. I mean, some states are figuring that out on their own. In California, for example, we've recently implemented a number of criminal justice reforms designed to take low-level offenders out of the system, in part because our system was so broken. The Supreme Court came in and said, prison overcrowding, horrible conditions, you must reduce your prison population by close to 40,000 inmates. And the idea was, we can identify individuals for whom it is simply not useful and cost-effective to lock them up for so long. And it turns out, I've done research along with my colleague Carol Saron here at UCI, turns out that you can do these sorts of major criminal justice sweeping changes and not harm public safety.
I'm going to be a little bit crude here, but we're talking about taxpayer money in most of these cases. So what pays off for taxpayers?
So, I mean, I think it needs to be a combination of what I would consider to be front-end and back-end solutions. So mostly what this country does are back-end solutions.
Well, like what? What are front-end options?
Well, there's a number of different things. So there's all kinds of treatment facilities, mental health facilities. We need to try and alleviate poverty. We need to help with housing instability. Civic participation should be increased. Police community relations should be improved. I mean, I could go down the litany of things that would
have— These are not small issues.
Not small issues. Absolutely not. I think that approach where it's really back-end focused, to the exclusion of front-end kinds of prevention, even though they're difficult, is in the end not worth it.
Charis Kubrin is a criminologist who studies the cost of incarceration at the University of California, Irvine. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
How much we as taxpayers pay for prisons is one thing. You can measure it and affect it with policy to some extent. But when a loved one goes to prison, finances can change overnight. Vita Ajamu and her family have been dealing with this for 23 years, ever since her brother was convicted of a federal conspiracy with intent to distribute and distribution of crack cocaine, with a mandatory minimum life sentence later reduced to 30 years.
My name is Vita Ajamu, and I live in Memphis, Tennessee. I am the sister of Robert E. Shipp. My brother is incarcerated, and he has been incarcerated since 1993. At the age of 20, my brother was indicted and charged with a crack conspiracy. In 1994, he was sentenced to life imprisonment without the possibility of parole. This was Robert's first drug offense, and he doesn't have a violent history. So there was much money spent for legal fees. Robert had two attorneys. And then you're talking about clothes for court, for the trial, you know, in all these different things. And then time off work for my father, time off work for my stepmother. My father was just like, I don't know what to do. We've paid all of this money. And he still got a life sentence. Well, the thing about it is, it didn't matter how much money they paid. What they didn't realize, based on the mandatory minimum laws, that he was going to get the sentence no matter what. A lot of inmates, they suffer because they don't have families or friend support. And they lose touch with them. We love Robert so much, we sacrifice. You have to pay for the travel, the gas, or the flight. You're paying for food. You're paying for photos. When I think about the money that I've spent, even the sacrifices of trading vacations, and that's the vacation, sadly enough, you know, that's thousands of dollars. So when I think about my entire family, it's tens and thousands of dollars easily. Because we're talking over a 23-year span. My father, it had been really hard for him to visit my brother, and he would visit and he would cry and he would really get sick. He went to visit Robert in May of 2012, along with my stepmother, my sister, and one of Robert's childhood friends. When he got to the prison, they checked him in and they look at your license and they look you up and they said to him, your license are expired. You can't visit him. They had driven from Chicago to Hazleton, West Virginia. In a rush to leave home, my father, he had just had his license renewed. He grabbed his license off of his dresser, and he had both on there, the expired license and the new license. The one that he put in his pocket was the wrong license. They said, well, I'm sorry, you can't visit him. It had been a few years since he had seen Robert because Robert had been so far away. So my father had to sit in the hotel for 3 days and not visit my brother when everybody else went to visit. He cried and cried and cried, and he never recovered from that.
Robert Shipp is scheduled to be released from prison in November 2019. He's missed the deaths of his father and other family members and the births of his three grandchildren. As their father was dying, Vita made him a promise.
I said, I will never stop fighting for his freedom. And that soothed him, and it calmed him. 3 hours later, he died. Does it weigh on me? Yes, it does. Will I ever give up on my brother? No, I will not.
If you have a story to share about the criminal justice system and how it's affected your economic life, get in touch. You can email us, weekend@marketplace.org, or leave us a message on our voicemail. It's 1-800-648-5114. Want a little snack? How about some avocado toast? Or a latte, perhaps? According to this guy, if you want to buy a house, knock it off.
When I was trying to buy my first home, I wasn't buying smashed avocados for $19 and four coffees at
$4
each.
So you reckon that's real, that people actually, young people, actually end up just spending their money and then whinge about the fact they can't get into the property market?
Oh, there's no question it's real.
That's real estate millionaire Tim Gerner speaking on 60 Minutes Australia. But hang on, is anyone really paying that much for avocado toast? And more to the point, is spending on small luxuries what's keeping people from saving enough for big purchases? Helene Olin wrote the book Pound Foolish, exposing the dark side of the personal finance industry, and she stopped by to share her thoughts.
I am now forever the first call whenever somebody says something like this. Avocado toast, cell phones, lattes, cable TV, you name it.
Well, I mean, the logic behind that is, let's say you are spending, I don't know, $15-$20 on a piece of avocado toast. That does add up. If you have it a few times a month or whatever, that could be a couple $100, I guess.
It has two problems with it. First, it's incredibly scolding and sort of saying, you know, poor people don't deserve anything, or middle class people don't deserve anything, as the case may be, right? But it has a bigger problem than that, too. And that is that it is mathematically challenged. Mm-hmm. our issues are not because we're buying too many lattes, as I wrote in Pound Foolish, or that we are spending too much money on cell phones to pay for healthcare, which was the thing from a few months ago, or that now people are buying avocado toast so they can't afford a home. What is going on, in fact, here in the United States is that our household income is still not where it was in the beginning of 2000. At the same time, the cost of housing, healthcare, education has gone up at rates well beyond that of inflation. And that's been going on for some time. That's actually been going on before 2000 as well.
You also wrote a book called The Index Card, which is about looking at really easy to understand ways to bolster your own personal finances. Because this does scare people. They think, well, maybe it is my extravagance. You know, they get into that mindset. So let's say you're 25 and thinking, I would like to buy a house. How do you start down that path?
I mean, the thing we talked about, the index card, was this idea of the myth of the small expenses versus the big expenses. It takes a lot of small expenses to add up to a big expense. So if you're trying to cut back, well, it makes it seem like you're accomplishing something if you cut back on, say, your daily latte. And to be fair, you are making a small cutback and you will probably, you know, save some money for doing that. If you really want to get anywhere, you need to cut back one of these big expenses like housing, like healthcare, because otherwise what happens is you tend to get swamped. I always use the example from Pound Foolish where I once decided this is it. I need to make cutbacks. And I cut back the New York Times subscription, which at the time you could read free online. And I was really proud of myself for cutting back this $30 a month. Then about a couple of weeks later, I got an invoice in the mail. It was December when this happened. My health insurance was going up by over $100 a month. And by the way, so was the deductible.
So if you are a millennial or even someone in my age group, you know, the Gen Xers, one of the things you advocate is saving 10 to 20% of your income, right? That's a way, just put it away. How do you do that?
I advocate striving to save 10 to 20% of your income. I am not saving 20% of my income. I wish I were. The way to do that is to, if you really want to get money aside, is to make it automatic and take it out of your paycheck before it hits your account. This way, you don't see it. A secondary step is to, if you really think you're just spending too much, is to not spend anything that is not cash. Because the studies show that when we hand over plastic or we do it virtually, and it could be, by the way, a credit card or it could be directed to your bank account, you will spend more money than if you hand over cash. Because we think of spending cash as physically painful. I think, as we all know, whipping out the plastic, handing over the cell phone, not painful.
I think one of the reasons this avocado toast thing was such a flashpoint is that it gets at both personal spending and personal finance and these larger social forces that we can't control. You've talked about median incomes, the cost of things like education and healthcare. Are there ways, do you think, for people to feel more empowered in their own financial lives and less at sea?
Well, I think the more you engage with it, the more you will feel empowered, right? That just is a certain amount of common sense. If you understand it, you will likely feel somewhat more empowered. But I think ultimately the way I understand it is to think of it as a political economic problem, which sounds very grandiose. And I realize that.
Yeah.
But if you think about it as, yes, you have individual choice, but that there's also forces that are frequently aligned against you, there's a sweet spot in there where you can feel empowered, even if you're not necessarily getting anywhere. At least you feel like, well, I'm not at fault, or this is under my control, or I understand my retirement account. And to me, at least, that's incredibly empowering.
Do you like avocado toast?
I love avocado toast, especially with salmon on it.
It's really good.
It really is.
Helene Olin is the author of Pound Foolish, Exposing the Dark Side of the Personal Finance Industry. Thank you.
Thank you for having me on.
Here on Marketplace Weekend, we are all about where the economy meets real life, which is why we're planning a show on life after college. Housing, finances, and of course the biggie, jobs. If you got questions, and yes, parents, that includes you, email us. We're weekend@marketplace.org. And while you're there, you can follow us on Twitter for updates. We are @MarketplaceWKND. It's time now for the Marketplace Quiz. That's when we ask people in the spotlight some questions about work and money and hear the lessons they've learned throughout their careers. This week, we've got a French rock band in the house.
Hello, my name is Thomas.
And I'm Laurent Brankovitz, but people call me Branko. We are half of the band Phoenix, from Paris.
Okay, so Branko, fill in the blank. Money can't buy you happiness, but it can buy you...
oysters.
Oysters, yeah.
Money is for oysters. And in the oyster, you can find a pearl.
Yeah.
So it's a cycle. Endless cycle of money. And food. Hey, Thomas.
Laurent.
In your next life.
Next or ex-life?
Next.
Okay, next life.
What would your career be? Knowing what you know now.
I read an interview of Sébastien Tellier, a friend of ours.
Yeah.
And he said that the most mysterious job there is for him was to be a referee. A sports referee. Mm. And just because I'm curious and a little masochistic, I'll try it. It'll be a different life. Maybe a hockey referee, because that seems like the toughest.
Would you be a honest or corrupt?
Maybe I'd be corrupted. I don't know. It's tempting.
Where would you hide the money?
I would hide my money old school style, in the mattress.
You remember Valenciennes?
I remember Valenciennes, Marseille-Valenciennes.
It was a
French game.
French football game, soccer game.
Yeah, and they hid the money in the backyard.
In the backyard, yeah.
Classic.
French style. Thomas,
mm-hmm.
Is there something you bought that you now regret buying?
It's kind of cheating, but it's something I was given that I would have bought. It's a book called The Rock and Roll Survivor's Guide. And it's a really cool book, but because it's sort of a coffee table book, it's on my bedside table. And it's just a source of high anxiety for me. Because it's all about how to keep your vocal cords not damaged. I wish I wouldn't know the damages that what can happen in the future. I'd rather be in denial. Laurent, what was your first job?
In a hotel. I would go to every room and, you know, tune the channels. It was an old school, you know, TV set. So it was very little knobs. And because I was young, I could do it, you know, I could reach it.
You had tiny hands.
Tiny hands. So yeah, that was my first job. Thomas, what is something everyone should own? No matter the cost, excluding human beings.
A piece of art, because you don't realize when you buy a piece of art, you don't realize how much emotional bond you create with it. And when you move, that's what you take with you. I remember my parents having art on the walls and just looking at it, thinking like that's weird. And but now when I see it, I go back to their house. I see it. I have a strong, like, to me, it's my childhood. So, Laurent, what advice did you wish someone gave you before you got into this?
It took us a bit of time to realize that people absolutely have no idea what they're doing. So if someone would have told me that, we would have saved some time, you know, trying to work with people who are supposed to be professionals. But in the end, they're just there. No, yeah, you should do your own thing. No one knows better than you, even if you're 16 years old, you know. That's a good advice. You, Thomas?
There's a good Ed Ruscha quote that I wish I would have seen earlier in life that says that good art should elicit the response of, huh? Wow. As the opposite to, wow, huh? And I wish I would have known that before. That's like you, when you're a teenager, you're ready to do anything to wow people really quickly. And you shouldn't lose your spirit and soul and depth.
For the wow effect.
For the wow effect.
Phoenix's new album, Te Amo, is out June 9th. And you can check out past Marketplace quizzes with Pusha T, Samantha Bee, and more. Just go to marketplace.org. Upfronts season is here. That's industry speak for when television networks unveil their big new shows for the fall in hopes of getting us excited and, well, enticing advertisers. And this season, there were a few shows in particular that I'm kind of geeking out over. Adrienne Hill covers entertainment here at Marketplace, and she joins me with the latest. Hi, Adrienne.
Hey, Lizzie.
Okay, give me the big reveal. What are the networks working on?
The big reveal, Lizzie, is it's things you've already seen before. It is a season, it looks like, of reboots, spinoff, revivals. American Idol was canceled. It's coming back. Roseanne is coming back. CBS has decided it is must-see television again, must-see TV. There's a Big Bang Theory spinoff called Young Sheldon. Will and Grace is coming back.
I've come home at last.
We've come home at last.
Are you excited, Lizzie? Are you feeling it? The nostalgia?
Wow.
Yeah.
I mean, it's the 90s, man. The 90s are back.
They're back. Big baggy sweaters. We're all there. So, you know, networks have had some hits and misses with these reboots, but Fox did well bringing the X-Files back this year, and it's also coming back.
Is everything a repeat? Is everything something from my high school and college experience, or is there new stuff?
Not quite. There'll be sports. That's new. Networks also do have some scripted shows they're working on. One that I think is really interesting for public radio fans out there is a show that's based on Alex Blumberg's podcast Startup. It's called Alex, Inc. It's starring Zach Braff, and here's a little clip for you.
Nobody thinks radio is cool, but when you do it, it's amazing.
Yeah,
I'm
nobody
sorry,
thinks
what?
So I have a lot of questions
Zach
about
Braff. How dare you?
Who this show is for? You know, is Alex Blumberg's life and podcast like? What's the crossover to network television? Very, very curious. Mm. And the fact they have to justify like nobody thinks radio is cool, Lizzie. But when you do it, it's amazing.
I feel personally victimized by that clip.
There's also a lot of, I mean, in general, just feel good going on there. A lot of shows trying to tap into that emotional sort of earnestness that was really the hallmark of This Is Us, which is one of the big network successes this last season. And I think it's a sense that we want respite from the very dramatic, insane real world out there. So lots of feel good, I think, is coming out this season. And more and more ways, as you and I, Lizzie, I know we love to sing along. Bye Bye Birdie. Live, Rent in the works.
Excuse me.
Go for
Adrian,
it.
Adrian, are you ready?
Let's do it.
525,600 minutes.
525,000 moments, so dear.
Moments,
okay,
that's how you
do it. Sunsets and midnights
and cups of coffee.
There we go. Everybody, congratulations. Right. Yep. I think they should hire us. There'll be a live version of Little Mermaid. So live television is where the networks are really looking to try to get people actually watching in real time.
Okay, but so many of these things are predictable. We know how they end. Why are they doing this?
Well, look, network television is a different model than places like Netflix and Amazon. Network television needs advertiser dollars. Advertisers love predictability. Advertisers want to know that they're going to put their ad for that minivan up against some piece of programming that's going to feel good and be safe for their product. This is still a place where you're trying to grab the biggest audience you can grab. Networks cannot afford to go niche in the same way that some of these streaming services can.
That an Amazon or a Netflix. And yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah, I mean, Amazon's trying to sell you shoes, right? At the end of the day, they want you to become a Prime member. So they're saying, hey, we'll entice you with these shows, but also buy your toilet paper from us.
Is anything changing?
This year, when you sort of look across the board, there seems to be more and more a move away from multi-cam comedies. These are sort of the traditional sort of formulaic comedies of our childhood, where lots of cameras are set up. They're cheaper to make typically, but they feel a little bit less modern. And we're seeing some of the networks move more to single cams. So, and big multi-cams like Dr. Ken, like Last Man Standing, Two Broke Girls have been canceled this season. So I think we're seeing some amount of the networks trying to respond to like what's cool and fresh and know they can't just churn out the same stuff over and over. But again, Big Bang Theory is like one of the most popular shows on television. It's a multi-cam and people still love it.
Okay, so apart from the opportunities for singing, which are great,
yes.
What else is exciting that's out there?
The Bachelor is launching a Bachelor Sports Winter Edition.
Really?
For real, they're counter-programming to the Olympics with Bachelor Winter Sports. So, yeah, look forward to that, Lizzie.
On this date, they luge, and only the top three get a rose.
You can just imagine, like, luging in bikinis. I mean, it doesn't seem like a good idea, but we'll see.
It really doesn't.
I mean, maybe it'll be so bad that it'll be good. I will, in fact, watch just to see what's going on there.
Marketplace's entertainment correspondent, Adrian Hill. As always, thank you.
Thanks, Lizzie.
Of the late Heath Ledger trying to get Julia Stiles to like him in 10 Things I Hate About You in 1999. And you could kind of consider it the original promposal, since they do end up going together, though there's also a fight and another apology in the middle. Anyway, since then, tons of teens have followed in his very elaborate footsteps.
Hey guys, it's Katie. Welcome back to my channel. And today's video is going to be a little bit different. It's going to be me asking my boyfriend Logan out to prom.
So I'm
going
to be asking Maddie to prom, and I'm going to be getting pulled over by a cop.
Hey Amanda, will you come to prom with me now?
I don't know if any of y'all watch The Office, but I'm going to be Jen for a minute and hopefully she'll be Pam. Oh!
What's happening? The scene from The Office. Oh my God, it's a letter.
Oh gosh, okay. Oh my gosh.
Read it out loud.
You make me happier than pretzel day. Prom?
And of course, she said yes. I mean, who says no on national television? So you see, prom is not just about the ticket, tux rental, one-tenth of a limo anymore. There's the promposal, the very public task of asking someone to prom. Photos, hairdos, jewelry, flowers. In all, many American families spend close to $1,000 on prom. Yana Kasparkevich is a digital reporter here at Marketplace, and she's written about prom and its price tag. So, Yana, will you go to prom with me?
Oh, Lizzie, I wish, but somebody already asked me.
So I realized that that question is, like, not one that could be asked in 2017 in that simple way. What is the way that teenagers are actually asking people to prom these days?
Well, in today's world, when everyone wants to Instagram, Snapchat, and Facebook everything, you really have to go big or go home. And that really applies also to asking someone to go with them to the prom. So that means either staging a flash mob or spelling message in flowers outside on a field or, you know, for example, recreating a La La Land video and creating what is now called a promposal.
I mean, that seems kind of insane for me to wrap my head around, and maybe I'm old and stuck in the mud. These things cost money.
Going to the prom also means getting a tux or renting one, getting a limo, paying for the tickets, and for girls it means getting a dress, getting their hair done, getting their nails done, getting their shoes. And so on average, teenagers and their parents spend as much as $1,000 to go to the prom.
You interviewed a bunch of teens and parents who were doing this. Did they feel like it was worth it?
Prom is the kind of last big thing you do at high school. So it's the big last hurrah. And so I think some people really feel like it is worth it to spend $1,000 for a really fun night out, and some really felt that they wanted to look their best because they would look at the pictures and remember the night forever. And I think that that kind of goes for the promposals as well, right? It's the last kind of big thing that you can do for your classmates to remember you. And so if you stage a promposal that's going to go viral, everyone's going to remember you as that guy who went viral the last year of high school. And I think that's a kind of even easier now with the media, and you know, we're looking for feel-good stories, and who doesn't like to watch teenagers sing La La Land songs and asking others to prom?
Does this put pressure, do you think, on kids and parents who don't have $1,000 to do this?
Yeah, and that has been kind of an issue for a couple of years. So prom used to cost as much as $1,000 as far back as, you know, the early 2013, 2012. And you, in the last couple of years, you have seen a bunch of nonprofits pop up that collect old prom dresses or take donations and try to reach girls or boys who can't afford to buy their own prom dresses or tuxes. And these nonprofits are called Operation Prom, Cinderella and Prince Charming Project. And they kind of try to make sure that there is no teen left behind when it comes to enjoying the prom.
I mean, I think about the costs that go into being a teenager today, cell phones being a huge part of this. Is it just more expensive to be a teen than it was, say, you know, when I was in high school in the 90s?
It probably is. And I think it also puts more pressure on you. Like, I think today when parents pay for both phone, you definitely need internet and computer to, you know, do your homework. The costs really do add up.
Jana Kasparkevich is a digital reporter from Marketplace. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Lizzie.
And if you are in any way interested, you can check out a picture of me in my 90s prom finest. Just follow us on Twitter. We're at Marketplace WKND. Or subscribe to our newsletter, and I'll give you recipes, Goodreads, the odd cat sweater photo. Just go to marketplace.org to subscribe. And that's our show for this week. Marketplace Weekend is produced by Eliza Mills and Haley Hirschman. Joanne Griffith is our senior producer, and Ben Tolliday is our engineer. Our theme music is composed by Naren Rao. Sitara Nieves is our executive producer. Deborah Clark is Marketplace's general manager. I'm Lizzie O'Leary. Thanks for listening. This is APM.